Welcome, and thank you for joining us for today's IBM teleconference, DB2 for ZOS Optimizing Insert Performance. Today's teleconference will be recorded, will last approximately 60 minutes, and will include a question and answer session. In this teleconference, we will introduce and discuss typical performance issues and concerns, design considerations, tuning recommendations, and capacity planning for data insert operations and DB2 for ZOS. The speaker for today's teleconference is John Campbell, Distinguished Engineer, DB2 for ZOS Development. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to our speaker, John Campbell.
Thank you, and welcome to this session on DB2 for ZOS Optimizing Insert Performance. Concurrent high-performance insert processing is one of the top challenges for any DBMS. And DB2 for ZOS provides a lot of functions and features to help you support high-performance concurrent insert processing. What I'd like to do in this presentation today is go through some recommended best practices, both for design and also for performance tuning, in the hope that it will help many of you with your batch processing. For many of you, there are particular batch processes that do very, very heavy insert processing, and basically there are tight technical and business deadlines to meet. So therefore, this whole session today is all about best practices. Now let's turn on to slide 2. My objectives of this session, basically, are to help you understand what are the typical performance bottlenecks, how to design and optimize for high performance, how to tune for optimal performance. There are some important new features of DB2 version 9 that can help. And basically, what I want to do is to introduce and describe those and to give you some education on how best to apply and use those new features. Now let's turn to slide 3. This is broadly the agenda for this webcast today. The first half, I'm going to be talking about typical performance bottlenecks and tuning and going through the topics listed on this chart here. And in the second half of the presentation, I'm going to talk about some specific performance enhancements in DB2 version 9 that can particularly help this area of high performance concurrent insert processing. Now let's turn on to slide 4. Here I've got a very important chart here which talks about some key physical design questions that you need to ask yourself as an application or database designer when designing a new process where you know you've got very high throughput requirements. And the first question is basically, are you trying to design for maximum performance throughput, or are you trying to design for space reuse? Secondly, of the keys that you're actually inserting, the new rows that are being inserted, is this key pattern actually somewhat random, or are we faced with a situation where we have a true sequential key, where the key is increasing, ever increasing sequentially? Next big question is, are we trying to store the rows in data rows in clustering sequence for efficient query processing later, or are we trying to optimize by inserting at the end of the table space to reduce synchronous I/O? Are we going to consider sorting the input records into the clustering key sequence so that we're inserting skips sequentially from the front to the back of the table space? And what are the indexing requirements of this application to support query processing? Are they justified? These are some hanging questions I'd like to leave, but they are important questions, and as we go through the various sections of this presentation, you'll understand the significance of those questions. Now let's turn to slide 5. There are some important choices here for the design here, and the basic choice is, do you want performance or do you want space reuse? Because in most cases, you can't have both. It's either performance or space reuse. With high performance, you'll probably get less space reuse, and if you want to get better space reuse, you're probably going to get less performance. Certainly in data sharing, the classic partition table space will usually deliver better performance than a segmented or universal table space. On the other hand, the segmented or universal table space usually will provide better space management due to the fact it has more space class information in the space map pages. I will talk later how a segmented and universal table space has 4 bits per data page in the space map. So it has many more combinations and give it better quality information in the space map as to whether free space is available in the page. Now let's turn to slide 6. So now I'm going to go into really the main first half of this presentation here and talk about the typical performance bottlenecks and some tuning observations. Let's turn to slide 7. So the first thing I'm going to talk about here now is basically I/O bottlenecks. And I'm really talking about synchronous read and or synchronous write I/O. Because as we know, read and write activity in DB2 can either be synchronous or it can be asynchronous. And with asynchronous reads and asynchronous writes, that processing is actually overlapped, hopefully, with the processing of the data. So what I'm particularly focusing in here, on this particular chart, chart 7 here, is about the implications of indexes and the implications that has on synchronous read I/O. Because if you drive up the number of synchronous read I/Os, that will drive up the elapsed time for each insert and therefore get less throughput in terms of inserts per second. So the first on this chart here, we're going to be talking about a random key insert to the index. And one of the key factors here is the number of indexes on the table. Now, if we take a three-level index, for example, we have a root page, one non-leaf page, and a leaf page, and some of those levels will be in the buffer pool. But, you know, often we assume as a designer, and often it's true in practice, that the root and the non-leaf pages will be in the buffer pool. But basically, the leaf page will not be in the buffer pool, and therefore we have to do a synchronous read I/O. So you need to plan on n, this number n, synchronous read I/Os per index. So if we assume that the root and the non-leaf pages are in the buffer pool, then the only read I/O is done for the leaf page. So therefore, as it shows on the chart here, the index read I/O time, and specifically synchronous read I/O time, is n, which is the number of, you know, I/Os to be done for each index, which in this case is going to be 1. So 1 times the number of indexes times the average synchronous read time. And I've just put some approximation in here of 1 to 2 milliseconds per synchronous single page read I/O. Okay? So that was for the index. Now, if we're trying to actually insert the data row in the clustering sequence, then basically we're going to typically have as well, we're going to have a synchronous read I/O for the data page. And again, it will be approximately 1 to 2 milliseconds per page. Alternatively, if we don't care about clustering and we want to insert at the end by design, or because the distributed free space has been exhausted, then we're typically going to be inserting at the end, in which case there'll be no synchronous read I/O for the data. And so for many high-performance applications, it's quite common to set the distributed free space to 0 and therefore deliberately, by design, try to insert the new data rows at the end of the table space or the partition, and that way eliminate synchronous read I/O for the table space by creating a tight locality of reference at the end of the page set partition, okay? And on top of that then, when we update the index page and we update the data page, in most cases in a well-performing system, this write activity is going to be deferred asynchronous write, and that will happen in the background, overlap with the other processing. And again, if we're talking about a random write to the index and a random write to the data, then although it's a deferred asynchronous write I/O, it's probably going to be 1 to 2 milliseconds per row inserted. Now, these numbers of 1 to 2 milliseconds per page, this is very dependent on the DASDI subsystem. It'll depend on the channel type, the device type, the I/O path utilization, and also the distance between the pages. The one important recommendation which I'd like to draw out of this chart, you can clearly see that the number of indexes is an important multiplier in the amount of synchronous I/O. So it's important there to keep the number of indexes on a table which has got heavy concurrent insert activity to keep it to a minimum. So when application requirements come along asking for lots of indexes for query performance, you need to challenge each and every one of these to see whether they're justified. Certainly, if you've got indexes which are pretty low value, and by low value I mean they're hardly ever used for query processing, then you need to look about either collapsing two or more indexes together or just get simply getting rid of the low-value indexes. So as I said, one very important point straight away here is to minimize the number of indexes on the table. Now let's turn to slide 8. Now, I started to introduce on the previous chart the idea of inserting at the end of the data set, inserting at the end of the page set partition. And examples of that are the data row insert that I previously talked about. But also, you can have this on the index because the key that you're inserting may be ever ascending sequentially, or it may be a descending index key. In all of these three cases, the data row insert, the ever ascending key, and the ever descending key, then we've created a tight locality of reference on the data set, and therefore we eliminate the synchronous read IO, the value of zero. But we do have the deferred write IO, but in this case, this deferred async write IO is going to be for contiguous pages. And therefore the cost per page is going to be much less. So I've put here as a rule of thumb here, approximately 0.4 milliseconds per page filled with inserted rows when you have sequential insert to the end of the index or to the end of the table space or the page set partition. Now let's turn to slide 9. One of the things to consider when you've got a high volume concurrent insert workload is what you're going to do about the write thresholds for the local buffer pool. So we've got the vertical deferred write threshold at the data set level, which now has a default of 5% since version 8. And we have the horizontal or DWQT, the deferred write threshold, which is basically across all the data sets in the buffer pool. And after version 8, the new default for that was 30%. But typically in a high-volume concurrent insert processing environment, it's very typical that you need to reduce the values of VWQT and DWQT to much lower values so you're able to ensure continuous trickle write activity between successive system checkpoints and avoid consuming all the local buffer pool resources. Now let's turn to slide 10. Continuing on this theme of buffer pools and read and write I.O., in some cases, people may decide, as a designer may decide, to actually have high deferred write thresholds. The problem with doing this is that then the vehicle for actually writing the updated pages, the dirty pages to DASDI, is going to be the next system checkpoint or an explicit stop table space or database command. And this is really not applicable in this scenario here when you have the high volume concurrent insert. If that data, if you're actually inserting sequentially to the index, inserting sequentially to the page set partition for the data, and the data is not likely to be re-referenced, then one of the recommendations here is to set the vertical deferred write threshold to zero, because then basically as soon as we accumulate 40 pages, we'll start scheduling write engines to dribble write out those pages which are contiguous pages. If you're not sure in each of these areas, then basically just use the defaults that are provided with DB2. Now let's turn to slide 11. So the second most important decision now, as a designer, is the distributed free space. What are the values that you're going to set for percent free and free page for both the indexes and the table space? So let's just, first of all, just recap and remind ourselves about why distributed free space is there. There are really three reasons, primarily three reasons. First of all, for efficient sequential read of the index. So what we want to do is that when we do a load replace or we do a reorg, we want to reestablish this percent free in the free page, some free space, so that basically when new keys are inserted, we want to make sure basically that there's room in those pages to actually absorb those keys, and then when we have a leaf page split, that rather than having to go for a new page right at the end of the index, we can find a free page nearby, and we can do a leaf page split and use one of those empty free pages nearby. And that way, if we have sequential processing through the index, it'll be very efficient in terms of using prefetch, and it won't degrade into synchronous read IO. The similar thing is true as well for the data. So if you have query processing where you do sequential set processing and reading via the clustering index, then by leaving the distributed free space for the table space, then as new rows are inserted, they are either inserted into the right place to mean true clustering sequence where they're dense, or they can be inserted into a nearby page so that when sequential prefetch is going through 32 or 64 pages at a time, even though the rows may not be in strict sequential order, they're in a nearby page. And again, we don't have sequential prefetch or dynamic prefetch degrading into synchronous read I.O. And the last thing, of course, is to minimize index split. If the insert keys are reasonably spread over the key range, by providing aggregate percent free, we may actually be able to avoid or certainly reduce the amount of index leaf page splits in between successive reorgs of the index. So it's very important to carefully consider these distributed free space parameters and think about your application and carefully calculate out the settings. I'd like to remind you about the default distributed free space, which is zero free page, and that applies to both the index and the data. And that's something, if you know a lot about your application and the processing, you may certainly want to challenge whether that default is the right thing to do. And the default percent free in the data page is 5% and 10% within the index page. Now let's turn to slide 12. So let me try and summarize up a little bit here. So if I was designing here for best insert performance, then the first question is the key, is the insert to the index going to be a random key insert or a sequential key insert? And if it's a random key insert, then the recommendation here is to use a non-zero percent free and or free page for the index to reduce the number of index leaf page splits and also to try and maintain efficient sequential index read. However, if you don't know any better than just basically, you know, to calculate precise values, then just go with the defaults. But do recognize that the default for free page is zero, which means if we have a leaf page split and there's not an empty page nearby, then invariably we'll have to go to a page at the end of the index partition, or the index at the end of the absolute end of the index here, to find a free page for the split. So the second half of that is, well, what happens if it's a sequential key insert to the index? So basically, the recommendation here is to set the percent free and the free page to zero. So after a load or reorg or the other utility listed on this chart here, then there'll be no distributed free space left, and that will reduce the number of index pages, and also have the potential to reduce the number of index levels. So we're only doing this, of course, because the inserts to the index are truly sequential, and therefore if we did allow for distributed free space, there would be no value from that, and the danger is we would increase the number of index pages, and worse still, increase the number of index levels. The third point on that chart is basically to use percent free free page zero for the data to create a tight locality of reference at the end of the page set partition, right? And what we're trying to do is basically reduce or avoid synchronous read and async write I.O. as the rows are actually inserted. So that is the most efficient thing, way of doing this, when inserting to the data, to try and eliminate or reduce synchronous read and write I.O. However, you have to recognize, though, that although this is the most efficient way to get the inserts done and absorbed into the table space or partition, you then got to recognize, however, that unless you do a reorg afterwards, then there's going to be a performance penalty for query processing that's processing rows sequentially through the clustering index. Now let's turn to slide 13. There's a trade-off, in fact, and a lot of trade-off in the DB2 algorithms for insert related to the usage of free space. And there are three things that we try to balance, okay? And there are a lot of logic here involved. So there are three things we need to consider here. First of all, if we insert to the end of the page set partition, this can be good because you minimize the cost of the insert by minimizing read and write IOs, get pages, and lot requests. On the other hand, if we try and search for free space near the optimal page to try and maintain clustering, then we're able to store the data rows in clustering index sequence. We're able to store the index leaf pages in the physical index key sequence, and we're also able to minimize the data set size. And also the third thing now, as we're thinking about trying to design for the best space we use here, by searching for any available space anywhere in the allocated area before extending, We've got the ability there to minimize the data set size and to try and reduce the amount of exhaustive space searching. And certainly having a large primary quantity, secondary quantity, and a large seg size will minimize the amount of exhaustive space searching. So to recap here, there's really three, if you like, conflicting things or things to be balanced in the free space search that DB2 performs. Let's turn to slide 14. Now I've got a chart here where I'm going to, a couple of charts, where first of all, I'm going to talk about the space search depths for partition table space, and in the next chart, I'm going to talk about the space search depths for segmented table space. And when I talk about segmented, they equally would apply to the universal table space. So first of all, item one here, then the first thing that happens when you do an insert is that DB2 Index Manager tells Data Manager what is the candidate page to actually insert that row. And DB2 will then look in the space map and see if there's actually space in that page to actually absorb that row. And maybe that page is full and we have to go elsewhere. Another thing as well with insert is that we use very conditional locking on the data page. And it may well be that that page is locked by another process that hasn't committed. So what do we do? So if there's no space in the candidate page, or the candidate page is locked, what DB2 then is at time two here, is he searches the adjacent pages. So he goes plus and minus 16 pages in the space map, looking to see whether any of those pages that are adjacent has actually got free space to absorb the insert. And again, some of those may be locked, in which case we'll skip over those. But what happens if there's no space available in the adjacent pages? Well, then we go on to step three. What we then do is go to the end of the page set partition, but we're searching for free space there without actually physically extending the existing allocation. Again, we may not find space there. What DB2 then does, basically, he basically goes to the front of the page set partition and, using the space map, searches from the lowest point at which he thinks there is free space based in the space map, and he searches forwards to the end to see if he can find space. And at the end of the day, he may actually have to extend the current allocation and then basically create more space and another space map, as well as creating a new data page to absorb the insert. But ultimately, we may have got to the very end of the extent, the prime quantity or the set quantity, and then what is DB2 going to do next? Well, at time 5, say he extends at time 5, and at time 6 is what he's going to do, is do an exhaustive search from the front to the back of the object to try and find free space to absorb the insert. And failing that, he will then go on to the next allocation. Now let's go to slide 15. This is the space search depth for a segmented table space. And this example here equally would apply here to the universal table space as well. So just like in the previous example, Index Manager will hand off to DB2 Data Manager and indicate the candidate page where the row should optimally be inserted. And there may be no space in that page, or the page itself may be locked by another process that hasn't committed yet. So what happens again, just like in the previous example, is that DB2 performs a search, searches the adjacent pages, but this time it's within the segment. So clearly now the size of the segment has a bearing here. So if you have a small segment here, there's very little opportunity to look for a space in those adjacent pages. On the other hand, if you have a large seg size, then there's much more opportunity to do some searching and find space in the adjacent pages. But it's adjacent pages within the segment. So then what happens if at this point we can't find space? Well, then what happens is that DB2 will go and search the space map page that contains those subject segments, and we'll look for the slowest segment governed by that space map, and we'll actually search all the segments up until the end of that space map page looking for space. We will then do, as in the previous example, we'll then search at the end without doing a physical extend at time 4, and at time 5 it will search right at the end with extend, and then finally it got to the end of the prior quantity or the set quantity, it's going to do an exhaustive search from the front to the back to try and find space to absorb the insert. Now let's go on to slide 16. One of the advantages of the segmented table space that also applies to the universal table space is it has the potential to be more efficient for fixed length compressed and true variant length row insert. And the reason for that is that compared to the classic partition table space, which has 2 bits per data page in the space map, a segmented universal table space has 4 bits per page in the space map. So there's many more combinations or conditions that can be represented in the space map. So the advantage is we can do better space searching and have a better indication when having fixed length compressed and true variant length rows where there's space in the respective page, and therefore avoid wasted trips. Having looked in the space map and found space in the space map, we then go to the page and be disappointed. The good news is with segmented and universal table spaces is you have a better quality information potentially in the space mapping page, and therefore when we do go to the data page, there's a reduced chance of the space not being available. However, there's also a downside, is that if you have these 4 bits per data page with a segmented table space, then we have to do more space map page updates. And particularly in a data sharing environment, when you're inserting at the end of a page set partition, this can cause a performance penalty due to aggressive page plock and page latch contention. So it can be either an advantage or a disadvantage. Now let's go to slide 17. One of the important decisions to be made here is actually the seg size. And the general recommendation ever since segmented table space was introduced back in version 2 release 1 was to use a largest possible seg size that was consistent with the size of the page set. So given that we're talking here about high volume concurrent insert processing, then it makes sense to go with a large seg size of 32 or 64. With a large seg size, you've got a better opportunity to find space in an adjacent page near to the candidate page and therefore maintain data row clustering, and also a better chance to avoid an exhaustive space search. On the other hand, with a small seg size, this can help to reduce space map page contention, but there's less chance of hitting a thing called the false lead threshold of 3. The false lead threshold is where DB2 looks in the space map, finds out the space in the data page, but then goes to the data page and finds out he's disappointed because not enough space to absorb the row. And basically what happens when the false lead threshold of 3 is reached, DB2 will then go and look at the end of the page set partition to find space. So with a small seg size, there's going to be, as I said, more instances where we won't hit the false lead threshold and therefore we'll do more exhaustive searching. Now turn to slide 18. Then we're now going to talk about max rows n, where n is certainly greater than 1. And this is an optimization that you need to be careful about, okay? It can either work very well or very badly, depending on how much work effort you put into in terms of doing your staff work to know how many rows can be safely inserted into a data page. This optimization is applied often to avoid wasteful space search on a partition table space when you have fixed length compressed and or true varying length row inserts, okay? And the problem here, as I said, is that in a partition table space, we only have 2 bits per page in the space map. So with fixed length compressed and true varying length row inserts, there's a risk of going to the page, data page, a heightened risk of going to the data page and not finding enough space. So one thing you can do here is basically trade a little bit of disk space. Basically, carefully estimate the average row size and how many of the average rows will fit comfortably in a single data page and back it off a little. So if you think you can get, I don't know, I'm making this up now, 10.5 of the average rows in a data page, you might want to set max rows to 10, slightly down, maybe 9. So if it's not 10.5 can go into the page, you may decide to set max rows to 10, possibly 9. And what happens is that when max rows is actually reached, when the number of rows reaches that limit, DB2 will mark that page as full in the space map and therefore take that data, respective data page out of the space search. Now, this can work very nicely provided you've done your staff work to round it and do your calculations carefully. But you need to recognize that there is an ongoing maintenance challenge, right? Having done the job properly to start with and designed it very carefully and get the performance you want and avoid these wasteful searches, then what you have to bear in mind, you need to maintain that decision. So there's a risk if you don't do it properly of wasting space. What happens if the table space was compressed and then you decide to uncompress it? Then this optimization will become unglued. What happens if you do it the other way around? You switch from being uncompressed to compressed. Again, the optimization can basically be undone. And what happens when you add new columns to the existing table? So these are some examples here of basically some DDL changes, for example, that can actually undo the optimization. Or if you get the calculation wrong, you can potentially waste a lot of disk space. Now let's turn to slide 19. Partitioning. Many people will just simply think about using partitioning for large tables to avoid hitting, you know, limits on them on 64 gigabyte limits. But actually, partitioning can help you very much with insert processing. With a partition table space, you use page range partitioning to divide the table space into multiple parts based on the key range. Well, assuming the insert keys coming in are not sequential, in other words, they're somewhat random, then the advantage here would be if you can try and spread the insert workload over the available partitions. This has the potential to significantly reduce logical and physical contention and thereby improve concurrency and reduce performance cost. Remember, for each partition, the index partition has its own separate index B tree, which is good for concurrency. In a non-partition table space, you have a non-partitioning index and with just one B tree for that NPI, non-partition index. And therefore, it will only support one concurrent index tree modification at a time. And an index tree modification, for example, an example of that is in fact a leaf page split. So by using partition table spaces, you end up with multiple index partitions, and each index partition has its own B-tree, and therefore you can drive up the amount of concurrency and have less impact on when you have leaf page splits. But however, there is still only one index B-tree for the non-partitioning indexes. And you can obviously see here that by using a data partition secondary index, you can get the same benefit as for the partitioned index of having multiple index partition data sets, each one having its own B-tree. So in many cases, customers will consider maybe over-wide partitioning of a table space, not because they've got a ginormous table space, but simply because they want to introduce multiple index B-trees. And also, they may want to reduce the number of index levels as well to reduce the performance cost. Now let's turn to slide 20. Data page size. On the assumption here that we're doing sequential inserts to the data at the end of the page set partition, you may want to consider using a larger data page size for the inserts to reduce the number of get pages, number of lock requests, CF requests, and so on, and also to get better space reuse. Now let's turn to slide 21. Historically, active log write, the physical log write, has been a bottleneck on many high-performance systems. But there have been many changes in technology over the years in terms of the DASI environment and also the introduction of DFSMS striping of the log. So it can support much higher levels. There's a calculation given here in terms of the megabytes per second of writing to the active log. Generally in today's environment, greatly advanced DASI subsystems, then we can safely, you know, without worrying too much, maybe write up to 10 megabytes per second without being concerned about the physical active log write. But if you're significantly above 10 megabytes per second, then basically you might want to consider the use of DB2 data compression for very insert-intensive workloads where the rows to insert are actually wide and compressed very well. Not only will it reduce the DASI space in the table space for the data rows, it will also reduce the size of the log record to be logged for these rows. Obviously, moving to a faster device, and you may want to consider the use of DFSMS striping there, because at very high logging rates, you'll be writing four or more log CIs per physical log write, and therefore DFSMS striping can greatly improve the log write throughput. Now let's turn to slide 22. This is a chart which is not totally up to date here, but it does show you the timeline here. On the y-axis there, we have the number of megabytes per second, and on the x-axis there, we have the technology, starting with ESCON channels and the Model E20, and going up to a DS8000 with two stripes and using FICON as well. So the rightmost one is FICON technology, DS8000, and two stripes. And as you can see with the technology here, one can scale to extremely high logging rates. Now let's turn to slide 23. I'd like to provide a few charts here to give you a rough, and I do say that, a rough estimate of the CPU time per insert. So this is the first level, and it's very, very rough here. And basically, this is CPU time in microseconds on a 9672 Z or Z17 processor. And what it shows, with, if you've got a table with no index, the range is 40 to 80 microseconds. If you have one index with no read I.O., it's the range 40 to 140 microseconds. One index with index read I.O., 130 to 230. And then the final example there, five indexes with index read I.O., and it jumps up dramatically to 500 to 800 microseconds. So you can clearly see here the number of indexes is a clear factor in the CPU cost of the insert. You can also see that the number of index read I.O.s is also a factor in the cost. And also the other reason for variation with the indexes is actually the number of rows in the table. A number of rows in the table will have a direct impact on the number of levels in the index. And clearly with an index at more levels, the CPU cost will be higher. So these are estimates based on this particular processor, the 9672 Z17, and you should use the IBM LSPR reference, basically, to adjust those CPU times to the particular modeler processor that you have. Now let's turn to slide 24. The next formula drops down to a little bit more detail here, and what you've got here is that on a 9672, again, Z17 processor, there's a base cost of 40 to 80 microseconds, and then for each index, initial overhead of 30 to 50 microseconds. And the third component of the formula here is 40 microseconds times the number of IOs. And on the bottom of the chart here is a worked example here, a couple of worked examples here of how to actually use the formula, which I'll leave there for your reference. Now let's turn to slide 25. Log latch and service task weights. Now, one of my first rules of thumb here for high performance is actually the log size. And general best practice here and a general design default is to use log size page, and only to use log size row in particular cases where you have concurrency issues and where log size row would help. So repeat that. Log size page, or any, should be the general design default and reserve just using log size row for particular cases where it can help you in terms of concurrency. One thing you need to consider is page PLOC contention in a data sharing environment. So if you decide to use row-level locking in a data sharing environment, we take the LLOCs on the row, which allows sub-page concurrency, but the system's respective members take page PLOCs on the associated data page. So one of the problems I often see with data sharing customers, the people using row-level locking, and either because the distributed tree space has been exhausted and therefore they're inserting at the end, or because basically their design intent was to insert at the end, that I see excessive page PLOC contention on the space map, but also on the data page. And I regularly see that probably once a month, in fact. So you need to consider, in terms of the lock size, what could happen in the data sharing environment. And in general terms, page PLOC contention in the data sharing environment can come on an index page update, it can come on the space map page update, and also come on the data page update when using lock size row. Now let's turn to slide 26. One of the things that we invented back in version 5 was an option on the table space called member cluster. Now what member cluster does, it's a trade-off, But what it does is it creates a member private space map and for the corresponding data pages. So the data, a space map services a collection of data pages. And basically you end up at runtime with a loose affinity between a particular member and the space map for insert processing. This solution of member cluster is particularly beneficial in a data sharing environment to reduce page PLOC contention and page latch contention, especially when the data is inserted at the end of the page separation. Typically, it's the most obvious area where you could have page PLOC contention in this case would be on the space map page, but it can also be on the data page if using lock size row. The trade-off here is that the inserted rows will not be clustered, so therefore you're biasing performance to get high-performance insert in a data-sharing environment against a group-buffable-dependent data set, but the trade-off is that you're losing clustering of the data rows. So, having said that, if you do have an insert-intensive workload and you don't have heavy update or delete processing against it subsequently, you may want to consider using lock size row, provided, and I say provided, you use member cluster and a large data page size to get better space use and to reduce the working set of buffer pool pages. Certainly, I would say that if you decide to use lock size row for the application, if you are in the data sharing environment and inserting at the end, then you must use member cluster with lock size row. But to repeat myself here, this is a special case here where having played member cluster with lock size row, then you might want to consider moving to the larger data page size as well. Now let's turn to slide 27. This continues talking about member cluster here. And there are two aspects of member cluster, one of which I didn't really mention yet. One is that when you introduce member cluster, we actually increase the number of space map pages. For example, with a classic partition table space, we could have 10,000 data pages serviced by a single space map. But when you introduce the member cluster option, you only get 199 data pages serviced by a single space map. So the size of the page set partition will increase, and you have many more space map pages when using member cluster. But an important point to consider at this point in time is that member cluster on version 9 is only available on the classic partition table space. It is not available on a segmented table space, and it's not available yet on the universal table space. In version 9, we removed your ability to create a new simple linear table space, because previously member cluster could have been used on simple linear table spaces as well. So several customers in my social circle basically created a single partition table space with member cluster to basically simulate the old simple linear table space on version 9. And why they did it was because there wasn't a natural or good partitioning key. Now let's turn to slide 28. Another technique to reduce contention in a data sharing environment on the space map pages, that's page PLOC and page latch contention on the space map pages, is to use track mod no. By default, track mod yes, DB2 will track in the space map page whether or not a page has changed. And this obviously has to be maintained. Now why does DB2 do this? DB2 maintains or tracks the change pages in the space map in order to improve the performance of incremental image copy. So if you decide to go with track mod no, the incremental image copy will still run. However, it will run for longer because now it will have to scan the whole table space to identify the change pages by using the LRSN value in the page. So basically, it's a trade-off here between basically, on one hand, degraded performance for incremental image copy, and on the other hand, getting better insert performance by reducing space map contention in a data sharing environment. However, if you're an installation that never runs incremental image copy, then why not set track mod to no anyway? And even if you do incremental image copy, then the trade-off may well be worth playing in order to get improved insert performance. Now let's turn to slide 29. DB2 in the statistics trace actually reports 32 latch class counters. And it's worthwhile when you've got very heavy concurrent insert workloads to take a look at some of those latch counters. And these latch counters will naturally have non-zero values here. But if some of these individual latch counters are more than 10,000 per second, then you need to seriously look at what is causing it. And two of the typical latch counters that run hot, particularly in a data sharing environment, are first of all class 6. This is usually used as a latch for the index tree PLOC when we have an index leaf page split. And bear in mind, and we'll talk more about it in the second half of the presentation, index split is particularly painful in a data sharing environment. Even after version 8 and the optimizations we introduced then, there are two forced physical log writes per leaf page split. And things that maybe you can do to help the situation is basically using faster active log devices so you log quicker, or by introducing more distributed free space, non-zero percent free, to try and reduce the volume of leaf page splits. Class 19 is for the logical log write latch. This is the latch that's taken when a particular agent inserts log record bytes into the log output buffer. And if this is running extremely hot, then one option is to run the load utility with log no instead of using SQL insert processing. In a very extreme situation, it might well be that the real storage is overcommitted and the log output buffer may be paging. So therefore, the solution here is to add more real storage to stop the log output buffer paging. Or another possibility is that log output buffer is unavailable because we're not able to write the log data out quick enough. So again, moving to a faster device or enlarging the size of the output log buffer can help. The thing to remember about excessive latch contention, it's not just the cost of the suspend resume when you have heavy latch contention. It's the fact that, as most of you do, and I'll recommend you to do, you have the accounting class 3 trace active, and each of these suspend resume events are all recorded in the accounting class 3 trace. So you have a double cost here. One is the cost of the latch suspend resume, each of those events, but also you've got the cost in the accounting class 3 trace of tracing each of these suspend resume events. Now let's turn to slide 30. Service task weights. Over the last few releases, we've done a lot of work to try and reduce these service task weights, particularly in the area of pre-formatting. Before DB2 can use a new page, it must be pre-formatted with binary zeros. You would know whether you had a service task wait here by looking in the accounting trace and looking at the class 3 wait time and number of events for the data set extend wait. This can typically be up to 1 second each time. But there were some changes made in version 7 to do anticipatory and asynchronous pre-format, okay, to reduce the wait time. There were some also improvements done also in version 9 to actually pre-format larger quantities and to trigger earlier. It can also be eliminated that when you run the load and the reorg utility, you can use the pre-format keyword option. And that, together with a high PRI quantity, what that will mean is that load and reorg will continue pre-formatting with binary zeros up to including the high pre-quantity value. But one word of warning here, consider the situation where you have a table that starts off empty and use a new table, and you switch to a new table at the start of every online day. There's a danger then that if you use pre-format on a table space, an empty table space with member cluster that's been pre-formatted by the load utility or reorg utility with a high PRI quantity, the very first insert will be extremely slow, because DB2 will open the data set and work its way backwards through the space maps to find the lowest space map that's got non-zero space. Now let's turn to slide 31. One of the challenges when you have a sequential key is how to generate that unique sequential key and to do it efficiently. The classic way of doing it, of course, was to have a one-row table and to read the row, update the row, and then commit. The problem with that is, particularly in a data sharing environment, it creates a single point of failure, because in the event of a member going down, it is highly likely you'll end up with a retained lock on that particular row or data page containing that row clock. And the other thing, of course, is that with you've got this single row table that's being updated, it also becomes a scalability bottleneck. So DB2 in version 6, 7, and 8 provided some enhancements in the area of introducing, first of all, identity column and introducing sequence objects, and then provide some functional improvements. With both identity column and sequence objects, DB2 will automatically generate a unique number on a sequential clock for the rows inserted into the table or inserted into the sequence object. And it'll do this with much better concurrency, throughput, and response time than compared to the classic application maintaining a row clock in a single row table. So there's potential here for 5 to 10 times higher insert rates per commit rates. There's also the option to be in data sharing. It's very useful to actually cache the number of keys in the individual members. So the default is 20. And this will reduce the number of DB2 catalog updates, okay, and eliminate the number of, or reduce the number of group buffer pool writes and log write forces, okay. And the enhancements we made over the years in the releases for identity columns and sequence objects allowed for the recycling or wrapping of the identity column or sequence values. Now let's turn to slide 32. Another option that we introduced was the generate unique function. This is even more efficient. This is a built-in function with no arguments, which returns a 13-byte string. It provides us a unique value, so it's not sequential this time, but it's unique to any other execution of that same function on your data sharing group. The allocation does not involve any coupling facility access. It's based exclusively on the store clock value, the time of day value, and the DB2 member number and CPU number are embedded in the value for uniqueness. And there's a simple example on the bottom of this chart here where you create this employee update table and you have the key called unique ID, which is defined as char13 for bit data. And you see then below that there's an insert into the employee update table where when it's on the values clause, we specify generate unique. Now let's turn to slide 33. Multi-row insert. Multi-row insert was introduced in version 8 new function mode, and it gives you the ability in a single insert statement to insert multiple rows. And we've seen for both local and distributed applications that we have the ability to reduce the CPU time. And the CPU time is reduced by avoiding the repetitive trips across the SQL APIs if we basically did these inserts one at a time. Now, we've observed up to a 40% CPU reduction by using multi-row insert instead of individual multiple SQL API calls to insert separately. The percentage improvement is going to be much lower if you have lots of indexes on the table and more columns, and or you have fewer rows inserted per call. So the actual mileage will vary. The atomic option is better from a performance viewpoint as it reduces the amount of logging that's involved. But there is an implication here in a data sharing environment when you have a very, very simple case, such as a table without any indexes or a table with just one index where there's no synchronous IOs. It's possible, particularly on a Z10 processor, that with a multi-row insert, you may be getting more duplicate RRSNs, and therefore DB2 will have to do looping in its code, waiting for the store clock value to move on. One thing that's particularly important here about multi-row insert is in a distributed environment, because individual inserts do not benefit from DRDA block fetch, but by using multi-row insert in a distributed client application, then basically we're able to do multiple inserts in one message, and therefore reduce the amount of message flow between the distributed application server and the back-end DB2 for ZOS database server. So by avoiding the message send-receive for each row, we can achieve even more impressive CPU time reduction, like up to four times, and even faster response time, up to eight times, with multi-row insert. Now let's turn to slide 34. In the second half of the presentation here now, I'd like to talk about particular performance features that are in version 9 that can help iConcurrent insert performance. Let's turn to slide 35. The first one is reduced LRS and spin and associated with that, reduced log lat contention. This enhancement is available in version 9 new function mode and is automatic, and it's for data sharing customers. Prior to version 9 new function mode, each successive log record on a particular member had to have a unique LRSN number, and the LRSN number was the high order 6 bytes of the store clock, so it effectively moved on every 16 microseconds. Well, obviously as processors became faster, particularly with the Z10, more and more customers with very simple insert cases basically saw some duplicates, and therefore what happened was DB2 would loop in its own code a certain number of times, waiting for the store clock value to move on, and it would also hold the log output latch, latch class 19, while spinning. So the nice thing in version 9 new function mode is that rule about each and every log record having a unique LRSN value has been relaxed. So now, log records only have to have unique LRSN values as it pertains to a single index or a single table space data page. And also, when we do have to spin to generate a unique LRSN, we no longer hold log output latch. This has the potential to reduce latch class 19 log latch contention, and also has the potential to reduce the CPU time when running on a particularly fast processor like the Z10. Now let's turn to slide 36. One of the very nice enhancements in version 9 is the large index page size. Now the large index page size is a hard requirement when you want to use index compression, but you can use the large index page size without index compression. And on this chart, I'm particularly talking here, and specifically talking, about using a large index page size without compression. Because index compression is not a performance enhancement. It will not reduce CPU. Index compression is very different to data compression. And the goal of index compression is to reduce DASD space. And that enhancement, index compression, was primarily aimed at informational style applications. We have lots of indexes on the table, and the total DASD space requirement for the informational application may be dominated by the index themselves, index spaces. So basically, index compression there is used to save DASD space, and basically the pages are not compressed in the buffer pool. So go back again to this slide here, slide 36. I'm talking about using a large index page size without index compression in an operational system. This has potential, two potentials here. A large index page size, even a modest increase from 4K to 8K, if the keys that are being inserted in the index are reasonably random, then basically this has the potential to reduce the number of leaf page splits, which earlier on I said was particularly painful in a data sharing environment because even after the optimization in version 8, we still have to do typically two forced log writes to the log, followed by writes to the group buffer pool. So by having a larger index page size, albeit a small one from 4 to 8K, this has the potential to reduce index tree log contention and index tree PLOC contention. It also has the potential, if used wisely, to reduce the number of index levels. So by actually having a large index page size, we can reduce the number of leaf pages and therefore reduce the number of index levels. So, for example, if we have a four-level index, then potentially we could end up with five get pages, typically. Four basic get pages to the index and one to the data. So, for the index, we have the root page, two levels of non-leaf, and the leaf page. So, by moving to a larger index page size, if we can reduce the number of index levels on one, we can reduce the total number of get pages from the index down from 4 to 3, and the total number of get pages for the insert from 5 down to 4, okay? So it has potential here to reduce index retrieval costs and therefore reduce CPU resource consumption. But I do need to tell you very strongly here that you need to be careful. For example, by going from, say, a 4K to a 16 or 4K to a 32K index page, if the reference to the keys is somewhat random or mainly random, you can end up aggravating your buffer pool hit ratio. and therefore having very much degraded performance. So when considering whether to go for a larger index page size, you need to consider increasing the size of the index buffer pool when the pages are primarily referenced randomly. Otherwise, you could get death by synchronous read I.O. if you keep the size of the index buffer pool exactly the same. Now let's turn to slide 37. Here's a bit of an example here of a 1 billion row table, and what it's showing on the left-hand side is the different page sizes, 4K, 8K, 16 and 32, and across the top, it's showing the index key length. And what I'm trying to do here is I'm showing an example of an index which is not using index compression. And what I'm trying to do is take a typical index key size and just illustrate with this grid or table what you can do with a large index page size. So 16 bytes is a typical index key size. And what you're seeing here with a 4K page size is that it has five index levels, okay? Now what you see is that when you go to an 8K page size, we're able to reduce the number of index levels down to four, therefore save one get page. And if we go aggressively into 32K, we can drop it down as far as three index levels and therefore save two get pages. So as you can see, it varies based on the number of rows in the table. It varies based on, the key length of the index. And then it will also vary based on the number of the index page size. So I just use 16-byte key here as an example for illustration. Now turn to slide 38. Increased index looker size. Again, this is something new in version 9, because prior to version 9, we only got index looker size on the clustering index. Now in version 9, it's possible to get increased index looker size on additional indexes where the cluster ratio is greater than or equal to 80%. So this is a potential for big reduction in the number of index get pages where you have indexes which have a very similar key structure to the clustering index. Now let's turn to slide 39. In version 9 new function mode, we have a function called asymmetric leaf page split. Prior to version 9 NFM, then whenever we did a leaf page split, it was always 50-50. So basically 50% of the keys went into the old page and 50% went into the new page. So you can imagine if you had an ever-increasing sequential key, you'd actually end up with an index that was quite disorganized, and you'd also end up with the leaf pages only being 50% full. So the idea of the asymmetric leaf page split, which happens automatically, is that DB2 will track the key values being inserted across threads. And it'll do this by storing some data in the leaf page. And what it will do, it will adjust the 50-50 split. So it may go 60-40, 80-20, may even go 100-0 when you've got a true sequential ever-increasing key. And therefore you can see that this in itself would have the potential to reduce the number of index splits by up to 50%, okay? So this is an automatic piece of function. The index keys being inserted do not have to be truly sequential. You see an example at the bottom there that following the APAR PK62214, that a simple case below here, yeah, is not truly sequential, but it is a sequential order going up. And this is typical in a multi-programming or data-sharing environment. So after this APAR, I expect to get much better value with the asymmetric leaf page split, particularly in a data-sharing environment. Now let's turn to slide 40. Randomized index key. This is an alternative type of index. We had ascending and descending before, and now we have a random index. Now this feature needs to be used very carefully. This is certainly not a general design default. Use of a random index can be absolutely fantastic with dramatic improvement, or it can be an absolute disaster with seriously degraded performance. And you also need to bear in mind that with a random index, this will lead to very poor query processing when you want to do sequential processing, or you want to basically apply range predicates like greater than, less than, in between. So let's just talk about what problem we're trying to solve, okay? The randomized index key is in the situation where you have a sequential key and hotspot. And what DB2 will do is take the index value and randomize it. But what we're trying to do here with the random index key is trying to reduce lock contention on the index. That's what we're trying to do. And it's a trade-off on one hand between reducing lock contention and on the other hand incurring additional get pages, read-write IOs, and increased number of lock requests. So like I said at the start of this chart here, this can lead to dramatic improvement or dramatic degradation. And a strong recommendation here is only to use randomized indexes when the indexes have a very good buffer pool hit ratio and where the subsequent query processing doesn't apply range predicates. Now let's turn to slide 41. Identifying unreferenced indexes. Clearly, if there are indexes in tables that are never used, there's potential for improving the performance of insert but also delete by dropping those unreferenced indexes. And the challenge before is, how do you identify whether or not those indexes are referenced or not, especially for dynamic SQL? So basically, additional indexes, as I said on the chart here, you know, require additional overhead for insert, update, delete, for the utilities, for DASD storage, and also the cost of prepare and bind. So let's now turn on to slide 42. In version 9, real-time statistics actually records in its tables, this is index space stats table, in a column called last used, it will record when the index was last referenced. And this value will be updated once in a 24-hour period. So at the first externalization interval after midday, DB2 will update this value. So if the index has been referenced by DB2, the update will occur, the last used. On the other hand, if the index was not used, there will be no update. So what do you mean by used? This means it's not used in the access path for queries, select query or fetch. It's not used on a predicate for searched, update, and delete. It's not used as a primary index for referential integrity, and it's not used to support foreign key access. So as you identify some not used indexes, they are potential candidates for deletion and thereby improve insert performance. The only word of warning I would say based on experience in this space is that sometimes indexes have value even though they're not referenced. An index may be of value because it, as a result of the index being there, RunStats will collect additional statistics, and thereby those statistics may actually help you optimize and make a better decision. So you may want to just consider that and save those statistics away maybe, or at least understand what's going on, so that if you drop the index and it adversely affects query performance, you may need to reinstate that index and its statistics to reinstate the status quo. Now let's go to slide 43. The table append option. The table append option has been introduced in version 9. And basically, on the create or alter table statement, you can append. You can say append yes. I have a very strong recommendation here to use the member cluster option on that same table if you're a data sharing customer. Now, the reason for this is what you're saying when you say append is you're basically saying to DB2, I don't care about clustering. I don't care about space use. I want you to log the insert and just append the row at the end of the page set partition. So in a data sharing environment, when using append yes, and without using member cluster, it is highly likely that the last space map in the page set partition will become very hot and have a lot of contention. So that's what's behind the strong recommendation to use member cluster with append yes in a data sharing environment. So the thing to realize about append is exactly what it is. It just depends at the end. It may drive the need for more frequent table space reorganizations. If you have a bulk delete at the front of the table, then the only way to reuse that space will be to reorganize the table space. Now, a question that commonly comes up here is, what is different about append versus what's called MC00? MC00 is a hint to DB2. It was introduced back in version 7 and also in version 8. And it's the combination of member cluster plus percent free zero and free page zero. And it's the absolute combination of those three things together that gives you the pseudo-append function. In actual fact, the percent free zero, free page zero, on its own has no impact on insert. Percent free zero, free page zero is only respected at load replace, for example, and at reorg time. But when percent free zero, free page zero is used in combination with member cluster, then this will optimize DB2 insert performance. And DB2 will append at the end, but before it extends, it will switch back to insert mode and try to find holes to insert the new rows into. And the success of MC00, I call it pseudo append, depends on the deletes and inserts being spread across the DB2 members of the data sharing group. Now let's turn to slide 44. Now what I'd like to do here is now summarize some of the key points out of the presentation. There are quite a few points here, but I'd like to draw out the most important points out of the presentation. First of all, as a designer, it's really important to decide whether the rows to be inserted are going to be inserted into the table space so that they're clustered with respect to the clustering index for subsequent query performance, or whether you're happy to insert them at the end, because clearly appending at the end has the potential to create a tight locality of reference, eliminate synchronous read I/O, and therefore significantly improve insert throughput. Secondly, if you've got a set of input records to be inserted into the table, it's a really good idea to sort those inserts into the clustering key sequence. And if those keys that are being inserted are dense enough, this can drive skip sequential processing so you can take advantage of index look-aside and sequential detection driving dynamic prefetch. Use classic partition table space and index partitioning for the best performance. Challenge the number of indexes. By keeping the number of indexes to a minimum, you actually have a dramatic effect on improving the CPU cost, performance cost of insert, but also delete. And if you find indexes which are low value, challenge them and consider dropping them. Tune the deferred write thresholds and the distributed free space to drive trickle write and avoid destroying the clustering of the table space. Use the large values for primary quantity, secondary quantity, and a large seg size to reduce the frequency of exhaustive space search from the front to the back of the table space. If you have tables which are insert intensive, wide rows that compress well, consider using ESA data compression, DB2 data compression, to minimize the log record size and reduce the volume of the physical log write. Use faster channels, faster devices, SMS striping for the active log write to improve the throughput. If you're a data sharing customer, use member cluster and track mod no to reduce page plock and page latch contention on the space map pages. And if you're using log size row in a data sharing environment, then again, the use of member cluster can not only help reduce space map page contention, but it can also reduce data page contention when using row-level locking. DB2 features such as identity columns, sequence object, and the generate unique built-in function provide efficient ways to generate a unique key, and also do that in the case of unique index by not using the coupling facility, but in the case of both also identity columns and sequence objects here, by avoiding the overhead and the single point of failure associated with a single row table where you continue reading and updating the key. And the last point to stress is, hopefully you appreciate this, there are some important new features in DB2 version 9, such as the large index page size, that can have lead to a significant improvement in concurrent insert performance. So that creates ends the formal part of the presentation here. What I'd like to do now is hand the session back to the operator so we can open it up for some questions. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Now we would like to ask you to participate in a brief electronic survey. Right after the survey, we will have a live Q&A session with the presenter. Your feedback is important to us, and we do appreciate the time you take to answer these questions. To participate, simply press the star key followed by the number that best corresponds to your choice. Please listen to all the options before making your selection. One moment, please, for our first question. Question 1, please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. If it was low, press star 3. You may vote now. Question number 2, was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference? If it was at the right level, press star 1. If it was not technical enough, press star 2. If it was more technical than I needed to hear, press star 3. You may vote now. Question number 3, what version of DB2 for ZOS are you currently using? If V9, press star 1. If V8, press star 2. If V7 or below, press star 3. Question 4. We hope you have enjoyed the teleconference today. Please let us know if you're interested in receiving additional information or follow-up regarding the products discussed today. If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. And that concludes our survey. Thank you for your participation. Now let's move to the questions. To ask your question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch tone phone at any time. At this time, I would like to turn it over to our speaker while we wait for questions. Our first question comes from Harry Shimagasha.
John, thanks for your presentation. On slide 30, you were describing a process where there was a time-consuming backward search of space map pages. And I was wondering, when you spoke about it, you talked about it in the context of an empty table. But I'm sort of curious why it wouldn't have to happen every time the table was opened and you did an insert.
By the way, what slide did you say it was, Harry?
Slide 30. It's the one where you say don't do pre-format when you have member cluster.
All right, well, slide 30, just so you know, I see what you mean. It's right at the bottom there, yes? So can you just ask you to repeat it again, please?
So when you said when you have an empty table that and member cluster, that the first time you do an insert, you do a time-consuming backward search of space map pages, looking for the lowest space map page with space to do the insert.
Yes, that's right.
Right. And my question is wouldn't you have to do that every time you open the table and do an initial insert?
No, it's just a first-time effect. It's the first touch of the table space, you know, when it's been opened. It's the first insert which causes it to be open. It's a first-time effect.
So in other words, every time you open and the first time you insert after opening, this occurs. Is that correct?
That's right. And what I'm talking about here is obviously an extreme case where people might have two tables that they flip-flop, and they prime one table by having it, you know, pre-formatted, load with pre-format with a high primary quantity, and then at a certain time in the operational schedule, they flip into this copy. And obviously that very first insert could be extremely painful depending on how big the primary quantity was.
Right. Because what I'm getting at is for the sake of argument, you might have a table that you do a lot of inserts during a certain period of the day, and then you stop doing inserts, and therefore the table closes. And then when you start up again the next day, assuming that you had a very large primary quantity, it would, when it opens and does the first insert, it will once again have to search through the space map pages backwards, even though there are already rows in the table.
That's true, but it'll just be less. If they did that each and every day, then that first time effects would become less and less each day.
Because the table would have to go backwards less.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Peg Geary.
Hello. I have a question about the sysindex space stats last used column. I just wanted to know if that was updated not only by a statically bound query, but also by dynamic SQL.
Yeah, hi there. It also applied to dynamic SQL as well.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Abigail Moore.
Hi. I'd like to pick your brain about table control partitioning since it's new to us. I did notice you said we get the best performance with classic partitioning and index control. One question I have is if we do something like adding a partition at the end, we must go to table control partitioning. And of course, adding an additional partition if we need it is so tempting. So I want to explore that a little bit with you. The other thing is, as I understand it, if we have an index that is a partitioning index just for the sake of partitioning, if we go to table control partitioning, we can drop that user index, which I would think would be a performance boost on an index.
Yes, it would be. But what I would suggest, if you've got an extensive this question about the partitioning, happy to deal with it, okay, but maybe we should just talk about that offline via an email, okay, because
okay.
In answer to your specific question here, if we go to table-based partitioning and we don't need that index to go and identify the rows, if we drop it, then clearly that will make the inserts and deletes faster.
Okay.
But if you have some more extensive questions about it, I mean, don't fear, just drop me an email because the email ID should be available via the slides here. And you can just drop me an email and we can continue the conversation, all right?
Thank you. It's a great opportunity.
Our next question comes from Kim Nguyen. Kim, your line is open. Please check your mute button. Our next question comes from Peter Buckland.
Hi, John.
Yeah, hi there, Peter.
I have the same question as the girl had previously on the partition table space and index partitioning, you say, on a summary.
Right.
Is there any special difference between index partitioning and table partitioning in this sense?
The thought of when I was talking about it in the context of the presentation, the spirit of this is where basically you either it's not a partitioning table space and you actually need this index, okay? Or it's already a partition table space. And what I'm trying to illustrate is that there's, you know, if it's a non-partitioning index, a non-partition table space, there is only one B-tree for the index. So I'm assuming that the index is there and it's needed for a good reason, right? And the point I'm drawing out is that if you have one B-tree or a limited number of B-trees, then basically there's an inherent limitation there because we can only do one index tree modification at a time. So by going from non-partitioning to partitioning or increasing the number of parts, provided the keys are spread over the range, we can obviously, you know, have more concurrency in terms of index tree modifications. Does that make sense?
I understand what you're saying, but my question is...
But clearly, if you don't have the index there, there's not an index there, and it's a partition table space where you don't have the index there, then there's no index B tree to be modified, is there?
Right, okay.
But then you could have some MPIs. You could have a table-based partition where you have some not secondary indexes. Now, if those are NIPSIs, you know, non-partition secondary indexes, this same problem of having only one index B tree still applies, doesn't it?
Of course, yes.
But if you can apply DIPSIs in this case, then each partition of the data partition secondary index has its own B tree.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Harry Shanglossen.
John, on slide 43 about append, in the section about the MC00 option, you had a bullet that said, success depends on deletes and inserts being spread across DB2 members of the data sharing group, close quote. And I was curious, why does it matter which member does the deletes?
Because each member caches where the first big space area is. So if all the deletes happen on one member, to take an extremer case, so you have two-way data sharing, if all the deletes happen on one member, the member where all the inserts happen won't see the space, won't be caching that delete.
So does that mean then, going back to my earlier question, that when you opened the table for the first time, you went and found this lowest space map page, and then this lowest space map page essentially gets updated, or tracking of that gets updated every time a delete gets done on the particular member?
Well, almost, I would almost agree with you, Harry. We track where we think the earliest hole is in the table space. So you may have a position in the table space, but then later on, somebody may, another process may delete rows that are effectively behind you. So the earliest hole could be well behind you now.
So in other words, initially on opening of the data sets, all the members have the same lowest space map page, but as time evolves, as they each do deletes, they diverge from each other.
That's it. You got it, yeah.
Now, again, in the MC00 case, before doing a physical extend, it goes and looks at that lowest space map page, but it only looks at those 199 pages, and if it doesn't find the space among those 199 pages, then it goes and does the physical extend?
Right. In the case of the MC00, it won't just be about, just one space map. He will go and look at that earliest hole, and he'll work his way through the table space.
So he'll do even with MC00, it will still do an exhaustive search?
Yeah, he'll go and fill in all the holes, working his way forward, yes.
And so the difference when you do member cluster as well as append is that the append eliminates doing any of this hole looking.
That's right. You're saying with append, all I want to do is literally do what the word append means, just append at the end.
Thank you.
And the introduction of the member cluster there is to deal with the issue if you're a data sharing customer and that table space happens to be GBP dependent, that last space map will get very hot.
Right. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Michael McBride.
Hey, man.
Hi there.
I was wondering on a heavy insert application if there's a benefit of the identity column over the sequence object over the generate unique function?
Well, if you take it on face value with the identity column is actually part of the table definition, right?
Correct.
But therefore, when you insert into the table with the identity column, we're inserting the row and we're populating the identity column at the same time. So it will be a sequential key, yeah?
Correct.
And so therefore you run into the classic, issues with a sequential key, where version 9 will help you, with the asymmetric leaf page split. So we introduced identity columns before we introduced sequences. So a lot of people simulated a sequence by having a dummy table or a control table, which all it had was the identity column, and they used that dummy or control table to generate the value, and then they transposed the digits. So the advantage of the sequence is it's independent from the table, you're going to insert the row into, and you can pull the value, and then you can just transpose the digits so you make it somewhat random. And, of course, the generate unique, if you can use it, is the best of all, because there's no update, in the catalog ever, and there's no use of the coupling facility. So if generate unique applies, then that's the very best solution in terms of efficiently generating a unique identifier.
Excellent. Thank you.
At this time, we have no questions in queue. I would like to turn the meeting over to your host, John Campbell.
Okay. I'd like to thank everybody. It was a very long session today, and probably some of you probably do have questions, but you're just probably exhausted now from such a long session. So if you do have any questions afterwards you'd like to follow on, then please just drop me an email, and I'll do my best to turn them around as soon as possible. So thank you very much once again for dialing in.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference.